Twin bomb blasts kill at least 95 people in Iran at a celebration honoring Iranian General Qasem Soleimani on the fourth anniversary of his death.
This is the deadliest attack in Iran since 79. There's nothing like it since the Ayatollahs took over.
It's another spark in an already tense Middle East.
Slava Ukraini!
Ukrainian soldiers come home in a prisoner exchange with Russia. And a simple fingerprint test to check for breast cancer could replace mammograms.
In 2021, breast cancer overtook lung cancer as the most common form of the disease.
Today is Thursday, January 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Iran says twin bomb blasts killed at least 95 people at an event honoring a prominent Iranian general killed in a U.S. airstrike in 2020. Iranian state media called the attack, which wounded more than 200, an act of terrorism. Reuters correspondent Rachel Graham.
Two explosions killed scores of people in Iran's southeastern city of Kerman, officials said on Wednesday. The blasts took place during a ceremony to commemorate top commander Qasem Soleimani, who was killed by a U.S. drone in 2020. Officials blamed terrorists, adding that dozens more were wounded in the attack. Iranian state television reported a first and then a second blast during an anniversary event at the cemetery where Soleimani is buried. An unnamed official told state news agency IRNA that, quote, two explosive devices planted along the road leading to Kerman Martyrs Cemetery were detonated remotely by terrorists. No group immediately claimed responsibility for the attacks. Videos aired by Iranian media showed dozens of bodies strewn around, with some bystanders trying to attend to survivors and others hurrying to leave the blast area. Head of the Kerman Red Crescent Society, Reza Fallah, told state television that his organization was investigating.
We are now evacuating the wounded and injured in the area. The crowd is huge and the job is quite hard. All the paths to there are blocked.
The assassination of Soleimani and Tehran's retaliation by attacking two Iraq military bases that house US troops brought the United States and Iran close to full-blown conflict in 2020. Soleimani had been chief commander of the overseas arm of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. He ran clandestine operations in foreign countries and was a key figure in Iran's long-standing campaign to drive U.S. forces out of the Middle East.
Reuters correspondent Rachel Graham. Joining us now to talk about this is Alex Vitanka, founding director of the Iran program at the Middle East Institute. No one has taken responsibility for the bombing, but given Tuesday's drone attack in Beirut, for many, the first thought was Israel, no?
Well, look, we don't know if it is escalation or not, depending on who did this. So far, we don't know who did it. If somehow Israel is involved, and, you know, that's an option, then it is an escalation of sorts. If another group is involved, then it would represent something different. I think, you know, listening to Iranian officials right now, the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei has not pointed a finger at anyone, and I think that's probably wise. His regime needs to figure out A, what has happened, and B, what they're going to do about it. In terms of Israel's potential role in this and the question of escalation, look, Mossad's been killing Iranian officials for over a decade, mostly senior folks. Nuclear scientists and so on, but they've never done anything like this. I can't point to an in single case where, you know, anything like this has happened or that Israel's taking credit for it. In fact, this is the deadliest attack in Iran since 79. There's nothing like it since the Ayatollahs took over. What we've had in the past has usually been at the hands of Sunni militants from the province of Balochistan, which is the province next to the province where these two bombings happened, on the border of Pakistan. There's a community of very disgruntled ethnic Baloch Sunni population that has, over the last few decades, produced a number of smaller groups of militants that have targeted the regime. They've used suicide bombings, other types of bombings, but this is, from what I understand so far, a case of two bombs being detonated via remote control. A slightly different tactic than what they've done in the past, but there's definitely a potential here for this as a case of domestic opponents of the regime, in this case, Sunni militants, maybe with the cooperation of ISIS in Afghanistan. I mean, ISIS in Afghanistan is an enemy of the Islamic Republic. So there is that connection. But, I mean, to answer your question a different way, Iran, the regime, has a number of enemies, both at home and in the region. It's too early to say who did it. And I think fundamentally, from what I have been able to detect so far, the regime isn't interested in a quick blaming anybody. I don't think they're interested in escalating regional tensions. Khamenei's statement today didn't mention the U.S., didn't mention Israel, didn't even mention ISIS, didn't mention anybody specifically, which kind of echoes what Hezbollah has done so far with the killing of Saleh Arouri. And even going back to last Monday, killing of the Iranian IRGC commander, Razi Mousavi. So
the people that have conflict with Iran, generally speaking, I know, you know, we can't talk about each specific beef that an organization or peoples might have with Iran, but generally speaking, their problem with Iran is that Iran meddles in so many affairs?
I would tend to agree with that. I mean, if you take Israel, and that's been one of my talking points. I mean, Israel didn't start this fight with Iran. It was the Ayatollah Khomeini in 79 who started it. So, and you can apply that sort of same reasoning when you want to understand the roots of, for example, Iranian-Saudi rivalry over the last few decades. It was Ayatollah Khomeini who started pointing to the other side of the Persian Gulf, calling those Arab leaders names and American stooges. So, yes, a lot of the times, Iran's regional agenda, which is essentially an ideological militant Islamist agenda, it perhaps from an ideological point of view advances Iran's regional interests. You know, you can point to Hezbollah or the Houthis or the various proxies in Iraq or in Syria, Hamas, Islamic Jihad. The axis of resistance has a mothership and it has a name and it's called Islamic Republic. And when you have a entity like that running amok in the region and kind of wanted to change the political order in many places, you will invariably create backlash. There will be, reactions to that. It very well makes sense to say that Iran's national interest would be in a different place today in terms of security of the country's economic standing, all the rest of it, if it pursued a different foreign policy and regional policy.
What does it say about their control over the country? The thing that struck me about this attack was the amount of time between the two explosions.
Right.
They had 30 minutes to prepare, react. You know, The second explosion was the more deadly one. It might be inconsequential what I'm saying. It might mean nothing. But they always give the impression that they're in total control of everything inside their borders, but it would seem not.
Right. Again, I tend to agree. And I think, it is consequential because this is a regime that has pursued a foreign policy at a huge economic cost. I mean, Iranians today are leaving the country because the country's economy is just in such a terrible state. So what the regime's narrative has been, well, for the sake of our security, we have to sacrifice our economy. Well, right now, your average Iranian is looking and say, well, you didn't give me economic security, and now you're taking my physical security away. Because these types of attacks, if you look at the last couple of years, you've seen an increase. Some of it you could put at the door of ISIS, the 2017, 2018 attacks and so on. But fundamentally, I think most Iranians are coming to the conclusion, and that certainly is the narrative of the Iranian opposition media platforms, and I think rightly so, to point to the very obvious, the elephant in the room. Look, when you go in the region and you create tension, you poke your neighbor, some of them, in the eye, don't sit there and assume you're going to be left untouched. They will come. If Israel feels that you're going to go for a kill, they have nothing to lose but to come after you. Again, I don't want to say this twin bombings here was Israel's doing. Time will show. Certainly not their modus operandi, but maybe the attack on 7th of October changed the way they calculate and they've taken a different approach to Iran. I don't know. Time will show. But I think the regime as a whole cannot but be embarrassed that not only did they not have the ability, intelligence-wise, otherwise, to see this, prevent this attack, but just from a very basic point of view, not having in Kerman on a very special day for a special man being commemorated, having the ability to say, something just blew up here, we got 28 minutes, and it turned out to be 28 minutes, to do something about it. Instead, if you listen to the videos and the sort of clips that are coming on social media, the regime supporters, the sort of ringleaders, have the microphones and are sort of chanting anti-Israel slogans, totally incapable of realizing that something big has happened here. Maybe we should do something to prevent more lives being lost. They didn't, but as you pointed out, that second bombing actually killed more people.
Alex Vatanka, founding director of the Iran program at the Middle East Institute. The United Nations Security Council Wednesday took up the issue of Houthi attacks on shipping in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. Chris Liu, a U.S. representative to the UN, pointed out to the council that Iran had enabled and armed the Houthis for years.
Iran has long enabled these attacks by the Houthis. Beyond Iran's longstanding provision of financing to aid such Houthi operations, since 2015, it has transferred advanced weapons systems to the Houthis, including unmanned aerial systems, land attack cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles used in attacks against maritime vessels.
The attacks on shipping by the Houthis have thrown commercial traffic into turmoil, with shipping being rerouted, which likely will make the cost of things you and I buy go up. VOA's Kim Lewis talked with Catherine Zimmerman, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, about this.
They have been devastating for commercial trade. Most of the major commercial shippers are now rerouting away from the Red Sea and instead going around Africa, which causes both delays in the delivery of goods and also increases expenses, which of course will be passed along to consumers. The real issue here is that the commercial traffic has been caught up in this geostrategic, geopolitical issue, whereby the shippers are simply trying to do private business and are at times being caught and told by the Houthis that they are supporting Israel when there's no evidence at all that that particular vessel was destined for an Israeli port.
Catherine Zimmerman, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis. A celebration as Ukrainian troops come home after being imprisoned by the Russians, as Ukraine and Russia on Wednesday conducted their first exchange of prisoners of war in nearly 5 months.
Слава Україні! Слава! Україна!
More than 200 soldiers were freed by each side after what Moscow said was a complex negotiation involving mediation by the United Arab Emirates. We're following these other stories from around the world. A transcript of the communication between traffic control and the two aircraft that collided and burst into flames at that Tokyo airport shows that only the larger Japan Airlines passenger flight was given permission to use the runway. The Transport Ministry on Wednesday released a transcript of the air traffic control communication that showed no clear takeoff approval was given to the Coast Guard plane. Paris Tuesday said its embassy in Niger was now closed, confirming previously announced plans after relations between the two countries deteriorated following a military coup in Niger. Argentine authorities have detained three individuals with Syrian and Lebanese citizenship suspected of plotting a terrorist attack in the country. Argentina's security minister and federal police each said on Wednesday that they are investigating the suspects' reasons for visiting Argentina and a 35-kilogram package sent from Yemen to one of the suspects. Sierra Leone's ex-president, Ernest Bai Koroma, has been charged with treason as part of the investigations into a failed military attempt to topple the country's government in November. The latest now from Reuters correspondent Alice Rizzo.
Sierra Leone's ex-president, Ernest Bai Koroma, has been charged with treason, a court in the capital Freetown said on Wednesday. The former president was being investigated by police in relation to a failed military attempt to topple the West African country's government in November. Gunmen attacked military barracks, a prison, and other locations in Sierra Leone on November 26. They freed about 2,200 inmates and killed more than 20 people. Authorities later said that it was a foiled coup led mostly by Koroma's bodyguards. Koroma, who condemned the attacks in a statement shortly after they happened, was summoned for questioning in December as part of the police investigation. On Wednesday, the charges were read out to the former president as he stood in the dock and some of his supporters cried in the courtroom. Another 12 people have been charged for treason, including Koroma's security detail. That's according to the government on Tuesday. The accused, which included ex-police and correctional officers, were arraigned before a magistrate in the capital, Freetown, on Tuesday, the Information Ministry said in a statement.
That's Reuters correspondent Alice Rizzo. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. In India, meager farming incomes prompted many in rural areas to move to the cities in recent decades. But after the COVID-19 pandemic triggered a wave of reverse migration from cities to villages, many are starting alternative farming ventures as they try to rebuild their lives in the countryside. And Jana Pashriga reports these ventures are raising hopes of reviving rural economies and creating livelihoods.
Pappu Kumar has harvested his first crop of turmeric. He hopes it will turn the farm he abandoned years ago in Hardial village in North India into a lucrative venture. Kumar said that there is benefit in growing turmeric. Traditional crops that they planted like corn and wheat often got diseases or stray animals used to eat the crops. That does not happen with this spice. Disheartened with the challenges of farming and the meager income it yielded, he was among thousands who left to work in cities. Vast tracts of farmland became fallow. He returned when the COVID-19 pandemic dried up urban livelihoods. He was inspired to grow turmeric by a retired army officer who, after coming back to his village, transformed his farms by planting the spice, which is widely used in Indian cooking. The hardy crop needs less labor and water. It is not attacked by animals such as monkeys and stray cattle. Turmeric is now being planted by scores of farmers. Other options to traditional agriculture, such as trout farming, are also getting attention since the COVID-19 pandemic triggered a wave of reverse migration. The fish thrive in cold water streams that crisscross the hilly region. Madhu Sharma heads the Fisheries Department at CSK Agricultural University in Palampur.
This is a good opportunity or good venture for unemployed youth. They have come back to their home and they are searching for such opportunities.
Arjun Kumar, a former building contractor, has built a successful venture selling trout and setting up a hatchery to produce fish seed. it has boosted his income. He said he has sold fish seed for $6,000 a year in the last 2 years and trout fish worth about $70 a day. Many find life in the countryside better than in the cities. Antanapa Sricha, VOA News, New Delhi.
And finally, a simple fingerprint test to check for breast cancer could eventually replace mammograms, saving lives and money, and increasing the number of tests carried out, according to researchers at Sheffield Hallam University. Here's Reuters correspondent Lucy Ha.
Can sweat from a woman's fingertip help detect breast cancer? Scientists at Sheffield Hallam University have developed a fingerprint test that offers a painless and non-invasive alternative to current mammograms. Professor Simona Francesa has been working in forensic science for almost 15 years, using fingerprints to help profile criminal suspects. But along the way, her research team realized that the same method could also be used to check for breast cancer.
Sweat contains a lot of different molecules, but what we're interested in is proteins. What we do, in effect, is detecting those proteins, and the different levels of expression of those proteins, the different patterns of expression, tell us whether a patient is has a benign pathology or has early cancer or is metastatic. And we use artificial intelligence to make sense of those mass spectrometry data.
In 2021, breast cancer overtook lung cancer as the most common form of the disease, accounting for nearly 12% of new cases every year worldwide. That's according to the World Health Organization. Traditional methods of screening and detection, such as mammograms or biopsies, are effective, but can expose individuals to radiation and cause discomfort. Francesa believes a non-invasive fingerprint test could someday replace the mammogram and encourage more people to have regular screenings.
Of course, in saying that, this is what we have at the moment, so I absolutely would encourage women to take those tests because they still save their lives.
Reuters correspondent Lucy Ha. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The world was profoundly impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic, which has claimed nearly 7 million lives, said Lois Pace, Assistant Secretary for Global Affairs at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, in recent congressional testimony. It's only a matter of time, she said, before the world faces another serious public health threat. In order to strengthen global health security against these threats, the United States is committed to working closely with the World Health Organization, or WHO. An effective global partnership with the WHO is essential to guard global health and well-being, said Assistant Secretary Pace.
WHO has been on the front lines of nearly every global health challenge over the past 75 years. Combating, containing, and curing some of the planet's most deadly diseases. Currently, WHO is responding to dozens of serious health emergencies, including in Gaza and in Ukraine.
However, the COVID-19 pandemic revealed major gaps in global health architecture, including at WHO, said Assistant Secretary Pace. To build up better global health infrastructure, the United States is working with partners to ensure rapid and transparent information sharing and to enhance WHO's ability to assess health threats and improve global implementation and compliance, said Assistant Secretary Pace.
We're advancing long-standing U.S. priorities to reinforce regional capacity and reduce risks posed by emerging infections. Ultimately, we're focused on finding sustainable solutions that break the cycle of pandemic, crisis, and complacency.
The U.S. was one of 59 countries that first signed the treaty establishing a World Health Organization. Since then, we've been party to many of its successes and at the same time have pushed the organization to be better over these last 75 years, said Assistant Secretary Pace. The United States is committed to upholding this legacy and protecting the world from the next global health threat.
That was an editorial reflecting